talk the whole night through.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. Good morning. Good morning. It's great to stay up late. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
When the band began to play, the stars were shining bright.
Now the milkman's on his way, it's too late to say goodnight.
So good morning, good morning, sunbeams will still smile through. Good morning to you
and you and you and you. Good morning.
Well, good morning indeed. It's very nice to have you with us on this 29th of December. We play that song, of course, to wish you a good morning, but also to remember the film icon Debbie Reynolds, who passed away one day off after her daughter died. She passed away yesterday of a stroke in California, and we'll talk about that later on. But it's a sad thing. I don't, you know, I always heard that these celebrity deaths come in threes. When did they start coming in 30s?
That was
I went through the thing today, this morning on CNN or whatever, Variety. 150 people from Hollywood died.
Wow. I mean, it's just and like icons. It's just, wow. Well. Yeah.
Jay Jankowicz from the Times Union on Facebook said, okay, those of you still alive, sound off by fours.
Right, and I wrote five.
All right, let me introduce the panel, and we'll get started and talk about this and other stuff as well. Joining us for the discussion, WAMC's Alan Chartok. Good morning, Alan.
Good morning. As I'm under instruction to have been embedded for two reasons. Number one, the snow is coming in the Berkshires big time. And number two, I'm practicing for being embedded for when a certain presidential change happens.
So you're never leaving your home then?
Are you in pajamas?
Probably. No, but I did something this morning that I shouldn't have done. I'll probably gain 5 pounds. I really needed a treat, so I made a baked potato. And there's nothing better in this world than a baked potato.
I thought you were going to say, like, oatmeal.
I thought you were going to say you actually ate.
Fudge. I thought it was Danish.
Oh, that's right. You had fudge for breakfast yesterday morning.
I did better today.
Raisin
toast.
Oh, that's much better.
Yeah. I have to go slowly back
I understand.
To normal.
I understand. Director of the journalism program at UAlbany and Raisin Toast lover, Rosemary Armeo, joins us this morning.
Hello. Good morning.
Good morning. And political consultant Libby Post is here. Good morning, Libby.
Good morning.
Very nice to have you here.
Thank you.
All right. Well, there is a lot to discuss. A lot's been going on. Let's start with Israel. We'll start there, where John Kerry made his final address yesterday and said that he accused Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel on Wednesday of thwarting peace in the Middle East, speaking with a clarity and harshness almost never heard from American diplomats when discussing one of their closest and strongest allies. With only 23 days left in his four-year term as Secretary of State, during which he made the search for peace in the Middle East one of his driving missions, Mr. Kerry said the Israeli government was undermining any hope of a two-state solution to its decades-long conflict with the Palestinians. The American vote last week in the United Nations allowing the condemnation of Israel for settlements in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, he added, was driven by a desire to save Israel from the most extreme elements of its own government. We will get to the I do want to say that reaction was immediate and harsh, not only from Netanyahu, but also from Senators John McCain of Arizona, Chuck Schumer of New York. President-elect Donald Trump did not even wait for Mr. Kerry to speak before condemning the Secretary of State. Alan?
Well, you know, as a Jewish boy who was raised on the west side of Manhattan, I can tell you with a real proclivity for and respect for Israel, the whole thing is very disappointing. Like many other people, I truly believe that the Israelis are making and have been making a big mistake. I am unequivocally for the Jewish state. But I think that they're making a lot of mistakes, including allowing these continued settlements to go up and up and up, because it's just a stick in the eye. On the other hand, and I think there is another hand, there hasn't been a lot of courage among Arab leadership either. We haven't seen it since we saw Anwar Sadat. who paid with his life for it. And when you keep the rhetoric keeps coming of we'll drive them into the sea and no compromise and making it almost impossible that we will achieve this two-state goal, it's not one-sided by any means.
Libby?
I have to say that I agree with Alan. As a nice Jewish girl from Long Island, Israel, I think the overwhelming majority of people in Israel want a peaceful solution. They don't want to live like this anymore. And I think the two-state solution is the only way to go. But on the other hand, as Alan said, the problem is here is that there's intransigence on all sides. And if people aren't willing to budge, if the Palestinians and their political organizations aren't willing to recognize the right of Israel to exist, it's very hard for Israel to go into negotiations with good faith. But somebody has to be a grown-up. Somebody has to be the grown-up in the room. And it would really be nice if Israel could be that grown-up and Netanyahu could stand up and say, we will come to the table, we will work for a two-state solution, we will stop the settlements so that we can stop the violence and stop the killing. But I just don't see that happening because they're very much entrenched. And you have a political reality in Israel now where the ultra-Orthodox rabbinate and community really controls a lot of the politics. And we know what happens when extremists of any religion control government. It's not a good thing.
How about a nice non-Jewish girl from Albany?
Right. Okay. I have a friend who hates the story Book of Cards because they said, I hate all the characters and there's no one you sympathize
with.
House of Cards?
Yes.
Yeah, because there's no good characters, no one you can sympathize. That is how I feel about the whole Middle East right now. Here's the situation we're going into. Trump will be the 10th U.S. president to try to make peace, and I think he has less chance than any of the 9 previous. You have a ceasefire announced today in Syria by the new players in town, which are Turkey, Russia, and Iran. Notice the United States was not part of that negotiation. We've been cut out of it. So you have, that's the players that you're dealing with on that side. On the other, you have Netanyahu, who for purely ego reasons has blown up what used to be bipartisan support for the United States for Israel. He is boorish and a bully in the same way I think that Trump is, and has endangered policy in the Middle East. Then you have John Kerry, who wanted to make peace in the Middle East his signature accomplishment and failed miserably, and working with Obama, who, okay, he's right about this. He's totally right. Those settlements are awful. Why'd he wait till his last month in office to do anything about it? This should have happened 4 years ago at the very least, when he was in the start of his second term and also did not have to worry about re-election. He's allowed He has allowed a personal vendetta with Netanyahu to influence American foreign policy. And what foreign policy do we have in the Middle East anymore? I think Trump is going to be another Netanyahu and increase what has been a terribly miserable 50-year occupation. The continued reality of Israel is no longer a question as it was in the 1960s. It is there. In fact, it's the power now in that section of the world. And what will we do with that? Are we going to fight Iran, Turkey, and Russia?
I think we're going to see a new axis of evil come out of this. Netanyahu, Trump, Putin.
Wow.
Okay, I think you're going to see
scary,
these three.
Isn't it?
I think Putin will come out strongly for Israel finally, because it's politically to his advantage, and he'll be able to broker some relationships between Israel and some of the Arab states that he deals with. Mm-hmm. But I think Netanyahu's a strong man. Putin's a strong man leader. Trump aspires to that. And I think that's what we're going to
see. And you're leaving out Iran,
who
has a lot to gain
and
lose
Turkey,
here.
And Turkey, who is ostensibly our ally, leaving us out of this negotiation. I thought when I read the story that we weren't even...
Not a good sign.
Right. It's not a good sign.
Let me jump into Alan, who I know is...
Well, no, I just wanted to get back to Rosemary and let her answer the question, which is why in the world do you think he waited this long, Rosemary? We all know the reason, because
I don't.
This is a post-politics. Yeah, go ahead.
I don't know the reason. I understand that he couldn't do it in the first term because he wanted to come back in again. But 4 years ago, he has 4 years to actually work on a settlement. And I think it was his extreme distaste for Netanyahu, completely understandable, that got in the way.
Well, Netanyahu had an extreme distaste for him.
Right. But two men, two failed leaderships. You talked about that. No one is an adult. No one's a leader.
Right.
No one is saying, all right, let's look at the terms for negotiating between the Palestinians, who also get my ire on this, and the Palestinians. Both of them have to agree to terms for the other ones before they'll even sit down. That, if they could agree to, you wouldn't need to sit down in the first place.
Right. And they
refused.
The Palestinians refused to sit down with terms.
Right.
And the Israelis refused to sit down without terms.
Right. And the Palestinians have said, all you have to do is just, stop those settlements.
Yeah.
Like, I'm sorry, that horse has left the barn.
Right.
The speech was a mistake. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I was just going to say, Rosemary, there was one other problem here, and that is American public opinion. When you have 88 senators or something like that coming out immediately in favor of Israel and opposed to Kerry's remarks, there is a recognition that the American people are still going to stand behind Israel as opposed to the Arab states, who they don't trust at all and who every public opinion poll shows comes out pretty low when you start measuring how important or how trustworthy any state is. Am I wrong about that?
No, because they see it all the Arabs as in one broad brush, a lot of these people, and they see them all as terrorists. They're all Iran, they're all Al-Qaeda, they're all, they're all evil. And so, and the other part of this is that, which isn't spoken all that much, but the far right in this country, and you have this downright, indestructible support of Israel from the radical Christian right, is because they want Israel to be there when Jesus comes for the second coming, because that's where he's coming back to. I mean, that's what this is about. It's not about supporting the Jews' right to a homeland.
Right.
It's about supporting this biblical space. So when Jesus comes back, he'll have a place to come back to, because he's not coming back to Canarsie or anything like that.
I do want to just talk before we go to the break a little bit about, as Rosemary mentioned, the Syrian government and its most important ally, Russia, announced on Thursday they had reached a ceasefire agreement with Syrian rebels and with Turkey, a potential turning point in a civil war that has lasted nearly 6 years and claimed hundreds of thousands of lives. So I'll begin with you, Rosemary, and ask about what you make of the ceasefire. Do you think it will last? And ultimately, because you mentioned that the United States was not even a part of that, should we have been?
Well, I mean, just look at the way it's structured. It's not a ceasefire. What they've said is that the Syrian military is not going to fire anymore because they've already quelled. They've already won Aleppo. It doesn't address extremists. It doesn't address all the bands of rebels that we never support it well. So I think the Syrians are going to still continue to bomb the hell out of them and secure Syria as a military state for Bashar al-Assad.
Alan?
And by the way, the Turks have made it clear that the ceasefire doesn't stand between them and their particular, what they call terrorist enemies in the region.
The Kurds.
So, and the Kurds. And of course, your point is, and always has been, is extremely well taken, and that is that Putin has won.
Yeah, Putin has won everything.
Right.
Including a favorable election in the United States.
And
Assad, too, you're right. Although he is a puppet to Putin now.
Yeah, but if the Senate's talking about sanctions and Obama's talking about sanctions, they've only got 25 days or so to do anything.
Yeah.
Because if the Senate votes after, because Trump could veto those sanctions.
And may I point out just the extreme rudeness of Donald Trump in the way he is conducting himself in this interregnum period between one presidency and the other. It is unprecedented by Republicans or Democrats that he is acting as if he supersedes the one president who was in the White House at this time. And yes, of course, our allies know it. That's why Netanyahu's tone is, you know, more obnoxious than usual. It's why Putin is laughing at America. He's not making America great by doing this. Yes, we get it. On the 20th, he can do whatever he wants. So wait until the 20th.
He can't. He's like a little boy.
There was a piece on NBC last night that talked about just that, and when, as Bill Clinton was leaving office and George W. Bush was coming in, and he was working on peace in the Middle East, and they asked George Bush's reaction, George W. Bush, and he said, quote, "There is at this time only one president. I stand by our president, and we will move forward when our administration takes over." We are no longer seeing that, obviously.
No. And so, from a president who wants America to be strong and powerful again, as it was when it was the undisputed solo superpower, I don't think he gets how extremely weak and mewling this makes us look.
And I don't think the rules of when you're no longer president are going to apply.
Right.
You know, they usually just are quiet and don't get engaged in international politics or anything, except Jimmy Carter has sort of flown in the face of that. But I think Obama's not going to be silent.
Okay, well, I have to really level a lot of criticism on Obama, too, because he had his chance at this. Mm-hmm. He is the reason there is this absence of policy. What are U.S. goals in the Middle East? I don't agree with Trump, but I know what his are. It's going to be to support Israel no matter what against all comers and to tromp on Iran. What was Obama's? What did he do for 8 years there? So, if he gets involved now, it's going to be a little bit too late.
Alan?
I take some exception, not because I'm endorsing Trump. I think what he's done in terms of interfering with the contemporary president is just wrong. But it is so Trump. I mean, that is what the guy does.
That's
he
right.
breaks all the rules. And I'm sure he sees himself as being very clever for doing that. It was irresponsible to say there was going to be a rigged election. It's going to be irresponsible the next time he says there's going to be a rigged election. It undermines the fabric of American democracy. And he's doing it again, and he doesn't care.
Yeah.
Well, let's pause there. We've got, that was a very spirited 20 minutes. That was great. Let us take a break and take a breath, and we will be back. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Alan Chartok is here, Rosemary Armeo, Libby Post, and of course, we welcome your letters. We will continue after this short break. Debbie Reynolds, I love this song.
I love her.
Yeah,
me
I love her
too.
19?
She was 19 when Singing in the Rain was done. And she is, you know, a rank amateur, and she's dancing with Gene Kelly.
Incredible.
Unbelievable.
Carrie Fisher was 19 when she did Princess Leia.
Yep. Yes.
I mean, that's also incredible. It's amazing. We will we welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org. We got some letters like this one from James, who says, as per the Atlantic, Politico, etc., when Clinton was Secretary of State, Schumer, at the behest of Netanyahu, threatened to publicly attack the administration if she didn't stop pressuring Netanyahu over settlements. Now he has attacked John Kerry over the same issue.
Yep.
Schumer has repeatedly put Israel first and should not be the Senate Democratic leader. Alan?
Well, you know, I'm a big fan of Chuck Schumer, and I don't always agree with him. I think he's going to be a terrific leader of the Senate. I think he's going to pick his spots. I do think he has an affinity to Israel. I don't think it can be denied. But so do most Americans. And, you know, from a political point of view, he's probably doing what's right. He represents New York State, of course. I think, you know, I always ask my students, what percentage of Jews are there in the United States? And some say 50% and some say 25%. And it's actually 2%. But in New York State, that's not true. I think he does it out of conviction. I also think he does it because it's politically correct for him. So you know, that's the answer. And should he be the leader? Absolutely, no question in my mind about it. He's going to be terrific.
Why does the Netanyahu government think they own U.S. foreign policy? Asks James. Yes, Israel has a right to exist.
Of course it has a right to exist. It is existing, will continue to exist. Whether it will continue as an occupier is the actual question.
Wesley asks, well, go ahead, Alan.
Well, then you get the whole question of what terms. There are people who feel that they have to come back and they have to be exactly where they were. You know, that ain't going to work either right now. So the whole concept of occupier is a definitional one, and I think it's going to be difficult to come to terms with that.
After 50 years, even that has changed. No one expects to go back to the 1967 borders. There are some, what do they call them, settlement blocks that are so built up, they'll never revert back to any Palestinian ownership. That's a given, too. So we're continuing. The argument has gone on for 50 years, and we're still using all the old terms, even though the conditions have changed.
Well, by the way, so are they. So are the Arabs.
Absolutely.
There are, I take great exception to the idea that they're not out there saying we have to. It has to be the way it was. In fact, they're still talking about that. And I don't know where you get the idea, Rosemary, that nobody expects them to, you know, that no, including them.
Read the Washington Post. Yeah. Read Mark Ginsburg, the former ambassador from Morocco. That's acknowledged by realists. The problem is, and you are right, I am criticizing at the moment Israel, but I could blast the Palestinians, mm-hmm. Who there should have been a two-state solution 30 years ago, and Palestine was a reason for that.
There was a two-state solution leaders on the table in the 40s.
Correct. There you go.
Okay, with an economic union between the two, and the Arabs said no.
Yep.
And so, you know, we could go back to that point in time and say, well, then all's fair in love and war.
Right.
But the fact of the matter is that we are dealing with the reality of today and the politics and the political pressure against Israel, even in this country, even within some factions of the Jewish community here. You know, there needs to be a positive step forward.
Let's forget about the leaders who you have rightly said are just not grown-ups and talk about the people.
Mm-hmm.
Israelis live under constant threat of bombing and terrorism.
That's right.
Every day. And Arabs are living in a military state with walls and restrictions and raids. That's no way for either one of those people to be living.
We go to this letter from Leslie, who says, whoever was speaking is correct. The strong men will prevail. We are at the point where all things need to hit rock bottom. One place she is wrong is that Obama was correct to keep hands off. Israel, Palestine is losing a battle.
I think she's talking about both of us.
Combine
the two. Yes.
Right.
It's okay.
A combined she.
That's right.
It's Wonder, a greater she.
Wonder twin powers activate. Chris writes, there's plenty of blame to go around, and there is bad behavior and bad intentions on both sides. That said, you can't ignore the vast asymmetry of military power and territorial control when comparing the Palestinians and Israelis. Pulling back settlements is not sufficient for some kind of peace, but it is necessary. Netanyahu is choosing to make any peaceful settlement impossible, Arab behavior and intent aside.
Yep.
So do you all think he's lying? I mean, he says he wants a two-state solution. And you think he doesn't. Is that what you're saying?
Even his own people say he has no heart. He says he wants it. He's not made a single step or sincere speech that would help to make it happen.
And the ultra-Orthodox don't want it.
Definitely don't.
So he doesn't want it.
And by the way, while we don't want to characterize everybody in one group that certainly is the group who are going to have Trump's ear in this.
Absolutely.
So, you know, so that's my thinking, Alan, that, you know, judging by the ambassador Trump has nominated, by his statements to Netanyahu during this past week, Schumer may be smart to say, okay, I'm not going to get a two-state solution. Give Trump what he wants on that and negotiate something else for it. That may be his strategy. We'll see.
We do have
Well,
we do have a question from Charles from Woodstock, who says, one thing I rarely hear discussed about the settlements is that a significant number of settlers and citizens in Israel proper believe that God gave them that land, i.e. the West Bank, and they have a God-given right to be there. Religious intransigence is the most stubborn kind. Please comment.
It's as in most of these hot spots of the world, it's religion mixed with politics. That's the real toxic brew.
Well, it's the anytime the extremists are in charge.
Yep.
Alan?
And you could go back to Samaria and Judea. I mean, you know, this never stops. Well, 19 this, and then all the way back we were there first. You know, there has to be some practical realization we're getting hurt here. But when the leaders get to be the leaders based on fear, right? Am I wrong about this?
Absolutely.
No, why would they give up that strategy? Mm-hmm. That means they're out of office.
We got this letter from Marty, who says, greetings. The reason for Congress's swift condemnation of the Secretary's brave and overdue remarks is because American foreign policy towards Israel is controlled by the AIPAC lobby. Representatives are terrified of offending the lobby lest the money go towards their opponents. Remember what happened to Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney? The unfortunate result is that Israel can do no wrong in the eyes of the American government, and anybody who says otherwise is an anti-Semite. Once again, money infects government policy. Time for campaign finance reform. Anyone want in on that?
No. Good comment.
No. No, I don't know that it's a good comment. I just think that, you know, there's too much assumption there that it's the AIPAC lobby that is responsible. No, I think it's widespread public opinion in this country that says Israel is our friend and the Arabs aren't. AIPAC, you know, they do their thing and they collect a lot of money and they lean on a lot of people. But I really don't think it's the existence of the lobby as much as it is the wider public opinion.
It's not Jews who flew the planes into the World Trade Center. And so it was Arab extremists. And so people are just going to see it that way until there's some shift culturally. I just want to go back to what Alan said before about fear. And one of my students in their last paper, because they were talking about the election, and I never thought about it this way, playing on people's fear, as Trump did, gave them hope for change. Hmm. And that's a scary equation, but it certainly did work.
Yeah, that's true.
We'll pause there. We're going to take a break. We're going to come back and continue with our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, and Libby Post. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back.
Anytime at all you're near me, 'cause you're near, you cheer me. That's a very special reason for a very special love. We don't need to speak a word, dear. Still each word is heard, dear. That's a very special reason for a very special love. A heart is just a heart, nothing more, nothing less.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us, as always. It is the 29th of December. I haven't looked out momentarily over the... Hey, Rob, is it snowing out? Okay. Rob says it's snowing out. Oh. So we hope you'll all be safe. And if you're just home listening to us, that's fine, too. We prefer that. But if you're driving, you know, pay attention and stay on the road and be safe. We let's go to some other topics before we move on, and because we are going to get a news break at the top of the hour, and we do have more letters, a lot of letters on Israel, but I do want to move on some of the on some of the other topics. So there was we saw the president-elect yesterday. He was in Palm Beach, and after having repeatedly praised President Obama's efforts to ensure a smooth transition, President-elect Donald Trump reversed course on Wednesday, accusing the current occupant of the Oval Office of putting roadblocks in his way. Trump took to Twitter shortly after 9 a.m., saying he was doing my best to disregard the many inflammatory President O statements and roadblocks. Thought it was going to be a smooth transition, not, the Republican president-elect wrote. The White House declined to comment on Trump's tweet and others that followed. And then the president-elect did come out around 5 o'clock last night and said that he had had a good conversation with the president and things were going smoothly. So we don't really know what to make of that.
No, you don't. You, the one thing with him is that you don't know whether he's lying or not. I mean,
well, and you don't know which one's the lie, right?
Right.
Right. So we do know there's some real difficulties between these two people. I don't trust when he says something like that. If the president comes out and says, yeah, that's what happened, the real president right now, then that's a different story.
I think Obama has his number, and he's he hears Trump tweeting. He gives him a call and goes, Donald, you're a big, strong man. You're going to be the leader of the free world. Let's work this out. And he's all flattered, and he goes out and then says, oh, yeah, everything is great.
Yeah, but he also knows how to pull the strings to make Trump tweet.
Oh, yeah.
So
the speech helped.
Yes.
Absolutely.
It'll be fun to watch as we go through, because what is he going to do? This is going to be the Twitter presidency, and he'll look like a fool after a while. So.
Robert Reich, the former labor leader under Clinton, came out with a blog post in which he goes, I don't think it should be a smooth transition, and I think Obama should throw up more roadblocks. And then he has a whole list of them, you know, like pardon every immigrant who has had a crime in the United States so that they can't be prosecuted under the Trump administration. He has like a series of these massive statements and things he could do.
Well, I was watching the president-elect when he came out at Palm Beach last night, and I think it's going very smoothly, very good. You don't think it's going smoothly?
Right. So he turns it back on them.
That's right. Yeah, no. Well, actually, we did until you tweeted this morning that it wasn't going smoothly, and there were roadblocks. What happened to that?
Oh, we had a few statements that I responded to, but we talked about it and laughed over it.
Yeah, everything's good. Everything's good until tomorrow when I wake up.
He had a good talk about things. He was in Hawaii. It was a very nice call, and I actually thought we covered a lot of territory.
I don't know. Maybe we should just turn off our Twitter accounts. This is crazy.
All right. Other issue, which is we talked about this a little bit, but the U.S. reaction to Russian hacking, and senators are calling for sanctions. We have been told that the sanctions or that an effort is imminent. But three prominent U.S. senators have warned that Russia and its president may face sanctions over the country's alleged interference in last month's presidential election. They said the move had cross-party support in the Senate. President-elect Donald Trump has rejected claims of Russian interference. Outgoing President Barack Obama is expected to announce retaliatory measures as early as today.
I think that this is the one issue that can really will define the Trump presidency and undermine it, because the Republicans in the Senate and many in the House don't trust Russia. And Trump is, you know, welcoming him with open arms and giving him the store. And the question is, if they do sanctions, can Trump then overturn them?
Undo them.
Undo them when he comes into office. Mm-hmm. You know, there's already sanctions and Putin is already hurting from other sanctions from the EU. And we lifted ours. But what can they really do? But I do think that this is going to be the one thing that's going to really undermine his presidency.
I think the Dems are bungling it again. Obama knew about this well before the election and waited until, again, the last month in office to do anything about it. And two, I think the Trump has been very adept at wiggling out of it. He doesn't go to intelligence briefings, but he says, oh, there's no evidence. And we are being told, no, we can't see what the evidence is because it's intelligence. So that kind of plays to the idea that there's not much there. I think he could wiggle out of this.
We'll see.
And it's horrifying to me because I totally think Putin is running the global show right now.
Oh, absolutely. He is the president of the world.
And he's not a good guy.
No,
I mean,
he's a horrible man.
Let me just say that, you know, it's again, this false equivalency business in which we say, okay, well, you know, and we've had letter writers who say, hey, we did bad things to the Russians and the Soviets, and now they're doing it to us, and that makes it okay. No, it doesn't. This is a bad guy. He's murdering people. He's putting people in jail. And maybe, and that's what worries me, there is a paradigm which could be followed by by this new incoming president.
Look, look what's happening in the world outside of the United States. You have the president of the Philippines who is sending out death squads to kill all drug dealers and users without any due process. In Venezuela, people who are unable to buy food are protesting in the streets and being squelched, being put down by paramilitary. This kind of vigilantism, this kind of corporate control and authoritarian control is coming directly from and is being supported by Vladimir Putin.
And that's fascism,
the
folks.
Man. Yes, it is. That's the man our president-elect
that's
is admiring.
That's the definition of fascism.
We have...
Yeah, and we don't... So I'm sorry, Joe, go ahead.
No, well, we just have many letters, and I'm going to get to a few of these before we go to a break. We got this one from Jeff, who simply says, Rosemary is on fire today. Go, Rosemary, go. So for whatever that's worth.
You're a fanboy.
Douglas says, it just occurred to me that the ultimate solution is very simple. All we have to do is send you folks over on behalf of the U.S. You should have it wrapped up before lunch with plenty of time to attack the president-elect. Brilliant.
Well, others have tried it. Bill Clinton thought he'd win. John Kerry thought he'd win the decision over there. It's a very difficult problem.
Alan, did you want to say something?
No, I was saying it's probably that.
Alan's eating something.
Yeah, no, it's a tongue-in-cheek.
No, I already had my potato. It's good.
Priscilla Young writes in and says, you do not mention top advisor Bannon even as so much about Trump's statement seems inappropriate. Chaos, Monkey Bannon's focus is to cause disruption, not be constructive. And Trump, he has found the perfect vessel. We have elected Bannon president.
It's true.
Judith says it's no surprise that Trump has behaved with such fundamental disrespect towards the Obama administration during this transition period. He has tried to delegitimize Obama during the past 8 years by his racist birther movement, acting as if Obama is not still the current and legitimate president now is consistent with Trump's past behavior. Good point.
And one last thing there, Joe, and that is, I know we keep saying it, but it seems to be lost in the conversation. She got 3 million more votes than he did.
That's right.
I mean, isn't that important to remember at all times?
When you talk about a mandate, she got the mandate.
He isn't. Trump is not the only person who has delegitimized Obama and treated him like a non-president. Let us not forget the Senate ignoring his pick for the Supreme Court, which, by the way, Robert Reich says he should be appointed. Merrick Garland should go in as a recess appointment.
But
he'd be in
can...
for 2 years, though. He'd be in until the end of December 17. No, 1 year, I'm sorry. Till the end of December 17.
Maybe there's a, what do they call those, September surprise. Maybe
right.
It'll be a January surprise.
Malcolm says, as a matter of principle, no government has an inherent right to exist. A government's power comes from consent of the governed. If Israel goes too far, maybe someday they won't have a right to exist. The same could be said about our own government.
Mm-hmm.
Well, but they do have elections, Joe, over there, and he keeps winning. You know, and he is not in political danger. So people who say, well, you know, if the people overturn it, yeah, well, the people haven't been overturning him. They've been getting the message that this is a strong man who will defend you and your children and your grandchildren, and they buy it. I'm not saying they should buy it. I'm just saying they do buy it.
Sounds familiar, huh?
Yeah.
Didn't we vote the same way in America?
Eric writes.
Well, I don't know that we did. Yeah, go ahead, Joe.
Eric writes, what is Israel's final solution to the Palestinian question? Seriously, what is the Israeli goal for their fellow Semites? Will settlement buildings squeeze them all into wire fence cages or simply force them into the sea? What is the ultimate plan here? What? We got this from Michael. If Obama really wants to continue making a difference and cement a legacy, I believe he should return to Congress like John Quincy Adams. It would display real courage and offer an example of what service to our country should be about, and that is the service. Has anyone knowledgeable about population growth in Israel-Palestine? Difference between Arabs and Jews make a single Israeli state a very dangerous place. If the birth rate of Arabs is higher, this makes a two-state solution safer if this is so.
One of the articles said that the Arab population in Israel is growing.
Yeah, it's much higher.
Carol says, who would have thought that we would be pointing to George W. Bush as an example of grace and decorum? My,
right.
How times have changed.
Right.
No,
that's
kidding.
True.
We miss George W. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Pete says, one small question. Do Palestinians have a right to exist? Quote unquote. I support a one-state solution with equal rights for all of its citizens. And Ray writes, what is the difference between the Israeli settlements and the North Dakota Access Pipeline? Isn't it just one race annexing another's land for a purpose for the former?
Self-determination, huh?
We will hold it there. We will get more letters. We will talk about more topics, and we will continue our panel and to our 10 o'clock hour. First, we're going to take a break. We'll check in with news with Ray Graff, who is standing by, bring us up to date on the weather forecast as well. And we welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We will be right back after this short break.
Support comes.
They say you found somebody new, but that won't stop my loving you. I just can't let you walk away. Forget the love I had for you. I could find somebody too, but I don't want.
Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, and Libby Post make up the group. I'm Joe Donahue, and we welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. Debbie Reynolds, the wholesome ingenue in 1950s films like Singin' in the Rain and Tammy and the Bachelor, died Wednesday, a day after the death of her daughter, the actress Carrie Fisher. She was 84 years old. Her death was confirmed by her son, Todd Fisher, according to her agent, Tom Markley of the Metropolitan Talent Agency. Debbie Reynolds was taken to a Los Angeles hospital on Wednesday afternoon. Mr. Fisher told the television station that she suffered a stroke. According to TMZ, she had been discussing funeral plans for her daughter, who died on Tuesday after having a heart attack during a flight to Los Angeles last Friday. Mr. Fisher said in a statement, she's now with Carrie, and we are all heartbroken.
Yeah, Carrie, she died of a broken heart, basically.
Basically, yes. Yep.
It's horrible. I mean, I went to see Rogue One over the weekend with my son, and the movie was great, and there was CGI of Princess Leia at the end, mm-hmm. you know, because it's the story
continuing
of how the plants of the Death Star were apprehended. And it's just sad. I mean, you know, Carrie Fisher was brilliant. And I posted on Facebook yesterday her speech at AFI when George Lucas got his award from them. And she was just acerbic and brilliant and funny. And Debbie Reynolds was an icon. you know, more than, I mean, I think younger folks may remember her as Grace Adler's mother on mm-hmm. Will and Grace. Mm-hmm. But she was, you know, started at 19, hoofing it with Gene Kelly and Donald O'Connor. She had never danced before, and they taught her, and she just did a tremendous job. It's just...
So I asked my mother if she would die if I passed away. And she said, oh, you mean I have to die to prove my love to you? She, you know, turned it around in that Italian mother way. It's so sad, and it just shows me that tie between mothers and daughters. Yeah. And I'm stealing this from my Facebook friend who wrote about that very eloquently. She has a daughter, and I don't. But she just didn't want to live after her daughter passed away. That's just so sad.
You know, you're not supposed to bury your children.
No.
It's just that simple. And, you know, they were talking about the family plot and putting everybody together. And, you know, and ostensibly she said to her son, I don't want to be without Carrie. And then, you know, she had the stroke. I mean, a book will be written about this at some point. But it's just sad for him. I mean, he's lost his sister and his mother in 2 days.
How about the granddaughter or Carrie's daughter lost daughter. Mother and grandmother in 2 days?
It is awful. And
I want them to fix this whole death thing. Alan, can you get them started on that?
I say again.
Just end this death thing.
Yeah. Well, we want to live forever.
Oh yeah. Okay. Ready now?
Yeah.
There are many things to, assignments of things to, first of all, you were talking about, she was an icon. I was telling the group yesterday, but I was watching Carrie Fisher's Wishful Drinking special on HBO. And at the beginning of that, she's talking about her mother. And she said, my mother is an icon. Okay, she was a gay icon, but she's still an icon.
It's true.
And so there was that. But also, people were saying, you know, we're going to watch Singing in the Rain now in honor of Debbie Reynolds.
I love that movie.
If you get a chance, please watch the movie Mother with Albert Brooks.
Yes.
She was brilliant in that.
I went to see it with friends. And my friends were like, I can't stand this. I was like, this is a great movie. I loved it.
It's just about this neurotic writer who moves back in with his mother.
His Jewish mother.
And it is a really wonderful. She is absolutely terrific. And just a little trivia, Albert Brooks had wanted and pretty much had talked Nancy Reagan into playing the role.
Into
coming back to the screen. And this was just when Ronald Reagan was starting to really feel the effects of the Alzheimer's disease, and she backed out and Debbie Reynolds came in.
But she could never have played that role.
Not to that degree.
No.
So
just say no.
Yeah, that's right.
Just say no. We don't have to worry about it anymore. But
I love
the portrayal
news.
Of Debbie Reynolds by her daughter, who, as you say, is incredibly acerbic and funny. And her mother comes off as kooky and totally the diva movie star. And yet you can just read it and know how close they were. It's really something.
Yeah, they loved each other. Mm. And, you know, Postcards from the Edge.
Yeah.
Semi-autobiographical. Meryl Streep and Shirley MacLaine playing Debbie. And
Carrie Fisher has a line in her special. She said, my mother said to me, you know, you should have a child with my last ex-husband because the baby's eyes would be beautiful.
Yes.
And Carrie Fisher said, now let me give that some context before it sounds weird. It is a different world, isn't it?
Yeah.
All right. And then the other story that I wanted to get to this morning is that about we will go back into politics, and that is about the cabinet. And NPR has an interesting story of talking about the basically doing a chart of the Trump president-elect's cabinet and breaking with a trend of diversity. Of the 18 people he has chosen thus far, Trump's cabinet has 13 white men. That's roughly in line with Ronald Reagan's initial cabinet. However, it's also a swing away from a trend toward diversity over the last few presidents. President Obama's cabinet in particular gained notice for its relative lack of white men. And there is a look at the cabinet in those terms. But there was also a chart which talks about the cabinet secretary's prior experience, mm-hmm. and basically breaks it down to government, military, business, or other. And when you look at presidents like George W. Bush and Clinton, and especially Barack Obama, the people that he had gone to were primarily government, were in prior jobs in government, where Donald Trump has gone mostly with either business, military, or the the ever concerning other.
Right. And people in government like Rick Perry, you know, or Tom Price, or it's really...
Well, I mean, that's what he promised. He was going to hire the very best people, and he was going to clean out the swamp. So is he doing what he said he was going to?
No. The swamp is just...
When the Democrats don't do what is expected of them in terms of diversity, that they are subject to much greater criticism than when a Republican or mm-hmm. Trump doesn't do that. I mean, I'm sure of it.
Well, I think Trump is just going to say, I'm getting the best people to make America great again, and that's just the way it is. And if you don't like it, lump it.
And white men are the best.
Right, and white men are the best. They're the ones who... I mean, when you look at the economics of this, you know, there are like a handful of these appointees who have more money in total than like 43 million people. And I mean, mm-hmm. it's really something. This is the 1% of the 1% of the 1%.
Yeah, it's definitely elite.
The other thing this chart notes is that there are four positions that he has yet to name, that those announcements are coming. Department of Agriculture, Veterans Affairs, U.S. Trade Representative, and Council of Economic Advisors. So those four still to...
One of the things we read this morning in the Times was on the Veterans Affairs thing. I think he's saying now that the Veterans Administration hasn't done a good enough job, so he's going to allow veterans to go anywhere they want. In other words, to get health care wherever they want. I think that's not a terrible idea.
Hmm. It's the step. It's one step away from vouchering for Medicaid and Medicare. So it'll be interesting to see how that works.
Libby.
Huh?
Yeah, it's a good point.
Yep.
It's a good point. But, of course, no matter what, we just keep hearing reports about the VA not stepping up. And that's terrifying because these are people who really fought for this country and who deserve the best.
Yeah, they need Sarah Palin in there to whip things into shape.
I guess she's not getting that position, huh?
You think not?
No.
The other thing, too, is two interesting things about this analysis that NPR did. One is that we've been looking at the military and how strong the military is within the Trump administration. Although looking at George H.W. Bush and President Clinton, 48% of the cabinet members had military experience on their resume, while it's only 28% in the Trump administration.
I think it's the level, though, isn't it?
Yes, it's the level of the positions and of yes.
Right.
Also, we should note that 23% of those in the Obama administration have had a PhD, 24% in the Clinton administration, 19% in the Bush administration, and 0%.
A big goose egg.
In the Trump administration.
That's a scary thing.
So how important is a PhD?
Alan, let's have Alan
answer
that.
I asked the man
Alan,
with the PhD.
Alan, how important is it?
Piled higher and deeper.
This is true.
As far as I'm concerned, you know, it doesn't mean a lot, except that it is a strike against the intelligentsia. And I do believe that that is how this election played out. And I think it's a path that Trump is following. You know, people who went to college are in a different spot now than they were in the previous administrations. And I think it's a signal. You know, you can't expect too much from me, from Trump, to do what's right in terms of bringing the best and the brightest, because I'm not going to do that.
Well, he did tell us that I love the poorly educated, yeah. And this is in some ways a massive and interesting experiment in what happens when you bring the practically intelligent, not educationally intelligent people into power. I will be watching.
Also, when you look at these numbers, and I want to move on to letters, but when you look at these numbers, they are very similar to the the Reagan numbers. Women were at 10% for Reagan, 20% for Trump. Meanwhile, Obama and Clinton had 36% and 29%, respectively.
Oh, good. We're only going back 40 years, Libby.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Nine whites, 17% in the Trump administration, 10% in the Reagan administration. And as I mentioned, 72% white men in the Trump administration and 81% in Reagan's administration. Okay. Judy writes to us and says there's plenty of approval for the UN resolution to stop settlements. It's disconcerting that I've heard no reports on this viewpoint alongside NPR News on Netanyahu tirades. Activist Israeli groups in a New York Times article on the 20th speak for all of us in favor of a two-state solution. John Kerry represented us so well. Thanks for your good work.
We spoke about this the other day. It is long been the international community's view that the settlements are bad, Israel is wrong, and a two-state solution is required. It's the U.S. reaction that has changed and thus is of news value right now.
And by the way, the Times and others have gone out to all of the major powers, and they're exactly what you just said, Rosemary. Mm-hmm. They're saying it was courageous of the Secretary of State, of Kerry, to do that. And, you know, there's one united voice on that issue.
Courageous, but probably futile because of the timing.
Yeah. Anne writes...
Probably futile only because it ain't going to happen. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I mean, I think that's part of what's really going on here. You know, there's this business of we're stepping in the way of a two-state solution. Well, as we've discussed at great length this morning, there is no two-state solution on the horizon. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's just the way it is.
Anne wrote, just heard in the news at the top of the hour, the objection representative to DISCO has to Governor Cuomo's plan to take speech on the road. That's the state of the state speech. Cuomo's spokesman's condescending and dismissive statement about DISCO sticking to his dog and pony show is massively insulting to the important work DISCO has done in that area. Alan, any comment on that?
I think DISCO is exactly right. You know, Cuomo is angry. When he gets angry, he gets little boyish. And he's angry at them for not giving him what he wanted and should have gotten, which is some kind of change in the way in which their ethical performance is judged. However, however, you don't pick up your marbles and walk away and say, I'm going to stop this tradition of all of these years of giving a state of the state message, and you guys can go join the Lumpet Proletariat. I just doesn't speak well of Cuomo.
Libby.
Well, I think this woman was actually referring to the animal rights work that Jim DiDisco has done over the course of his tenure as both as an assemblyman and now as a senator, and hopefully we'll all be able to work together to get some legislation passed. But I think that was the insult for this woman. It's calling it a dog and pony show.
So. Larry says if the 400,000 settlers decide to remain in the new state of Palestine, will they be ethically cleansed and forced out due to their religion, or will democratic Palestine welcome them and as them to remain? I'm serious.
Well, I'm not, and I'm not going to answer that one.
Okay. Norman says, before you, Rosemary, lament that Putin is the prime mover in the Syrian war, consider that in the long game, Russia will bear the burden of rebuilding Syria. Russia's per capita GDP ranks 73rd of 229 countries. Their per capita GDP is less than Israel, Portugal, Spain, or Italy, for example. How can he do it? He can unless Trump bails him out. Consider also that Putin has already made a large financial commitment to Russia's military machine.
Putin does not care a whit about his people. None of these authoritative leaders that he is propping up around the world show any compassion for their own people. Let's start with Assad, who's just killing them, bombing them. It's all about money in the bank and military power.
I don't agree with you. I think, in fact, Putin is very intent on keeping his people happy. And one of the ways he does it, as all great scoundrels have, in the past is to throw them this kind of red meat that he's been throwing them, whether it's building more nuclear weapons, whether it's, outfoxing the United States. He is clearly concerned about it. And by the way, Rosemary, he's been very popular and very good at it.
Well, they like beg to differ. You come off as very popular when you jail or kill all the opposition. Pussy Riot, the girls' band, sang one song about him and spent 2 years in jail. Everybody's happy now. Nobody's singing songs anymore. That's not the same thing, Alan.
By the way, and once again, I think you're saying that I said something I didn't say. I don't like it. I don't think it's good at it. You said that you didn't think he cared about what his people do.
I do believe that.
He does care a whit.
No.
Yeah. I think he wants to win. I think he wants to win, and he knows all of the techniques, just as Donald J. Trump does, of throwing red meat to the masses.
It's not by making people happy. It's by jailing, oppressing them, and spending their money on state needs the military.
But I'm sorry, were you going to say something? Alan? No?
I said I'm done.
Oh, okay.
I'm done.
Right. Well, simple as that.
The horse is neighing. I said the horse is neighing, beating the horse. Yeah.
Got you.
Mr. Ed.
Go ahead, Alan.
I was just going to say no reference to anybody on the panel. No. I just thought that, beating the horse, going around and around, that's all.
It's like saying, that Fidel Castro made his people happy. He repressed them. It's not care for people. It's managing them. That's all.
Remember when the Bay of Pigs happened? And
yes.
The assumption was that the Miami rebels would come aboard and the people would turn on Castro. Never happened. Castro was a brutal, mean dictator in many ways. But there's health care, there's education. It may not have been at the top of the scale, but it was sure there, and an awful lot of people loved Castro.
Or the American invaders have been such idiots and incompetents that the Cuban people rightly realized that they were not going to be freed by these people and so should be careful and be quiet, just stay away.
Yeah, so it's a matter of alternatives. It's a matter of alternatives. In other words, are we better off with these people who are coming off the boats, or are we better off with what we have? And clearly, they thought they were better off with what they had. They didn't want to go back to Batista days.
All right, and we got this. We got this from Virginia. Says, "I love Rosemary's mother. Everything I've heard about her says she's an intelligent, sharp, witty person. Maybe she should be invited to join the panel one day. Bet it would be a hoot." Well, she was with us one day.
Yeah, live panel. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So.
Mom's slipping a little. She's 91. She kind of forgets things. She might forget who she was talking to.
How's that different than any of us?
That's true.
Yeah, right. I think we all do that, don't we?
I haven't remembered a lot of things.
All right. We're out of time. I want to thank everybody. Alan and Rosemary and Libby, thank you very much for being with us. Travel safe, everyone, on the snowy day. Stay warm indeed. We will be back with another panel tomorrow, and we will continue the roundtable after this short break.
Happy New Year.